I'm Bay, and you're listening to Bay Baltimore, a weekly pop culture and society podcast recorded in a quiet neighborhood. Well, I said I was going to stop saying that. Recorded down in downtown Baltimore. That's what I said I was going to start saying, because it's not always quiet. Anyway, I watched Wakanda Forever, like I said I was, and I'm going to talk about it. And I think there's so many different things that I want to talk about that I think first what I'm going to talk about is the, I'm just going to talk. I might drop a few spoilers. It is what it is. It's been out over a week, not over a week, but it's been out a week. It's been out a week now. I'm not the first one to drop a spoiler in the world. What I will do is if I do drop a spoiler, I will, make a note about it. Or I'm telling you, spoiler warning now, I'm going to try to hold back many of the major details, but I'm definitely going to talk about aspects of the movie because of the conversation that's happening around it. I will remind you that this movie, and even the way that it's been, they moved forward with the second one, not having T'Challa because of Chadwick Boseman's passing, you need to understand that it's still basing, the movie is still based off of the source material, which is the Black Panther comic books. We know that there were so many different opportunities to, or at least directions that Coogler could take this film in, and this series, this franchise in, because of the source material, right? And just general imagination. So I want to talk about, so I wanted to start there. For anybody who might be feeling away, I've already seen the videos on TikTok of folks that were like, between The Woman King and this, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, you know, they're really trying to target and simp to Black women. And I just think that that's a wild statement, because both those films, and go with me again, Black Panther, If you paid attention to the comic book, shoot, even if you watch the BET animated series from the 90s, if you watch that animated series, you have an idea of where Coogler is going with the entire franchise. Woman King, we already know Woman King was based off of the Dahomey warriors, so I don't really understand where this vitriol is coming from, apart from people just wanting to remain relevant to a particular group of folks, and alienate a bunch of other people in the process. But I know that by now you have generally heard, if you haven't seen that, I know that you've heard reactions to the star, the villain of the film, whose name, shucks, I didn't forget his name, because the actor Tenoch Huerta, I think it's Jose Tenoch Huerta something. He's got a long name, but he goes by, in these interviews, he goes by Tenoch Huerta. Of course, you know, Letitia Wright's in it as Shuri, and Shuri's role is changed. But we knew that was going to happen after. Well, two things. We knew that after Chadwick Boseman's passing, that Shuri's role in the film was going to be changed. But again, if you go back to the source material, that the pathway was already laid for us to have a larger conversation about Shuri and her role in Wakanda, and the Wakanda leadership. We also knew that, again, even if you watch the animated series, if you, some of y'all have not watched the animated series and are not familiar with the comic book and the shows, because if you watched the very first episode of the animated series, sets the United States up as an enemy to Wakanda. Point blank, period. So for anybody that's saying, oh, this is, again, going back to the, you're pushing a leftist agenda sort of thing. The comic book, this is based on the comic book's agenda. The conversation that's being had is a modern one, but it's a modern twist on an old conversation that the original comic book started. So United States is not, is showing itself in the second film, it's showing itself to be an enemy of Wakanda. But before it fully shows itself to be an enemy of Wakanda, you know that we left off in the first movie with the United States and Wakanda being cordial. You know, Wakanda being its own independent country, fighting a villain for hire, basically, right? But that they're agreeable. They have a decent relationship with the United States and neighboring countries, even in on the African continent. But definitely, the United States plays a role. Why? Because we know that Michael B. Jordan's character, whose name I've forgotten, was a Wakandan born in the U.S., but a Wakandan nonetheless. And so that conversation about the diaspora, I think was important there. And for so many different reasons, and we all remember that moment where for a second there, it felt like the diaspora was together. And then, of course, we devolved into diaspora wars because that's what we do at the end of the day, because colonization and colonization mindset. But there's a continuation of this conversation in the second film, but not in quite in the way that you think. Again, I'm going to speak high level when I finally get to it, but I'll talk about that higher level conversation about colonization. I will also just tease out for a second the conversation that his friends call him Kukukal. I know you've seen that clip before. Kukukal. I don't know what his enemies. There's a line where the quote unquote bad guy ? Says to Shuri, because they're face to face. She asked him. Shuri asked him his name, and he says, "My friends call me Kukukal. My enemies call me this other name." And in the, I'll get it eventually. I just forgot it right now. But anyway, there's a conversation that Kukukal is having, and certainly there's an approach that he takes that is pretty radical, and there's a rationale for why he's making this he's taking this approach. I will talk about this after the break, because the same his approach in the film, the actor's approach to the character, and certainly the character's actions evoke the same conversation that Michael B. Jordan's character evoked in the first one. Now, mind you, I think most of us landed on the fact that Nakia, Lupita Nyong'o's character, was essentially saying the same thing that Michael B. Jordan's character was saying, but just nobody was listening to her. I think there's an argument for that. I think there are two things. I think Nakia's character, and we'll talk about that, or Nakia. Nakia, who, if you recall, was T'Challa's love interest in the first film. Nakia wanted to be, so if Wakanda was neutral, Nakia wanted to even be more neutral, because remember, I think that the shift in the first film was that Wakanda wanted to, was T'Challa was at the point where he was deciding whether or not his country needed to come off of the fence of neutrality. Whereas Nakia was like, no, we need to remain neutral at all times. We need to definitely remain neutral and help and provide aid when we can. Actually kind of act like the UN. You know what I mean? Like, remain neutral unless being pulled into it. And again, from her place of neutrality, she made certain points that ultimately Michael B. Jordan's character made, only he made it with more fanfare and bombast and strong-arming Wakanda to make a decision. And Nakia did not. And I think, well, I know in this second film, she, because of, everyone was grieving in this film, and you know this, right? Everybody's reacting to grief and moving on with life with a hole in their heart from T'Challa's absence, right? So we'll come back to that. But her approach to grieving, and certainly some things have happened following the passing of T'Challa that certainly have made her, has made her renew her mind on how she moves in the world is the best way that I can put it. Whereas before, she was on the side, very much still active, but on the side and very neutral, on the sidelines and very neutral, sort of, in the kingdom. She takes a back seat completely following the loss of T'Challa. Or at least it's perceived that she's doing this following the loss of T'Challa. We come to understand that there's another reason. And again, I'll get back to, let me decide if I want to share that reason. But Nakia plays a pivotal role, a more prominent role in the second film than she ever did in the first one. So again, in the first film, Nakia is the voice of reason that nobody's listening to. And instead, we listen to, well, we're forced to listen to Michael B. Jordan's character, who takes the same logic, but then takes it to the nth degree and destroys and just like wrecks shop, right? So she's sidelined in the first film. She initially sidelines herself in the second film, but then she is called to do a very specific task. Remember, Nakia is a spy. And so there is a moment where she shifts and you recognize, number one, that she's a truly talented individual. And number two, she's really powerful. And number three, she's really skilled at what she does, and can be trusted to handle some big tasks for Wakanda. And so we see in the film that she's done that. So we're seeing shifts of characters. The loss of T'Challa has shifted the characters and the trajectory of a lot of different characters in this show or in this series. And there's a question of whether or not what that act truly means. I feel like this series has a little bit of a hole in it, or this movie has a little bit of a hole in it, but I'll get to that in a second. But what I really want to talk about before I get more into the film is, and certainly I'll talk about M'Baku and the general, whose name I've forgotten, and I'll have all those names. I'll talk about all of that in the second film, and then what I hope will be shot up out of the franchise. Riri Williams is in it. If you don't know who Riri Williams is, she is essentially the new Tony Scott. She's Iron Woman. Like, she's smarter than but in the series, again, y'all need to at least reference the series. Do not just go off the films. But the comic book series tells us that Riri Williams was smarter than Tony Scott. Tony Scott had he was smart, but he also had money and access to resources. Riri Williams is getting it out the mud. And so, because she's literally that smart. And so anyway, she makes an appearance in here, and there's a very real reason why she's in it. And it's a little bit scary. And it has everything to do with Kukulkan. Kukulkan. And his plan. Who else do I want to pull out? I think I just, and the queen. The queen mom herself. The queen mum herself. Whoo, boy, there's some stuff happening. There's some stuff happening. And so in a minute, I'm going to talk, in the next segment, I'm going to talk about grief. But not in the way you think. I'm going to talk about grief in the film, from the context of the queen. But first, what I want to talk about is the actor, Tenoch Huerta, who I've come to know is not an indigenous man. He identifies as Latino, but he's brown skin. He's a brown skin Latino. One of those that you don't necessarily see on TV. And he's very outspoken about that. If you listen to his interviews as he's walking around promoting the show or promoting the film, maybe not necessarily in American TV, but definitely in Mexican TV or at least Spanish speaking TV or interviews, he's going in. And I think he's speaking to his audience, right? Like, not every conversation is for every audience. That's the same way that anybody from a, like, if you were speaking to your community, you would have bring up different content or you'd have a different conversation than you would when you're speaking to a broader audience that doesn't necessarily only include your community. That's what everybody does. And so I've been listening to interviews that he's been having, and I'm learning that he's very outspoken about brown Mexicans being represented. And he said some very bold statements that I think as an outsider looking at telenovelas occasionally, I've noticed that everybody was very white looking, and understanding the history after World War II, at the end of World War II, a lot of Eastern Europeans, a lot of Germans, a lot of people that were connected to, I'm just putting it out there, a lot of people that were connected to Hitler's regime to escape punishment, they fled to South American countries. And even though Mexico is not considered to be a South American country, they certainly did get their fair share. Shoot, not even World War II. Let me finish this thought and then let me go take it a step further back. So what we know is that at the end of World War II, a lot of Hitler sympathizers and Hitler connected people fled to South America to start their lives over there and assume new identities. And what we know is the Nuremberg trials, a lot of those investigators went down to South America to capture some of these German folks who were trying to perpetrate, who had been living for years in one of those South American countries trying to fake the funk, but were caught and brought back up for the Nuremberg trials. Or not even the Nuremberg trials, but over the years, captured. Unfortunately, many of them were not captured, and there are podcasts about the folks who fled to South America and were never captured. But nevertheless, there are whole films, TV shows. Shoot, even Evita has a nod to the whiteness of Argentina, or at least the white class of Argentina, which in many ways was populated by folks escaping from Europe to live there and assume new identities. And so, well, I don't know about, I don't, actually, I'm sure that there's a part of that history that's there. I invite you to go do your own research, but we know a lot of Germans fled to, a lot of Hitler-connected people fled to South America, right? What you may not be familiar with if you're from the United States, or even if you're not from the United States, what you may not be familiar with is that a lot of Southerners after or before 1865 or just after 1865 emancipation, when the war was declared over, fled to Mexico. There are whole towns in Central Mexico, Central America, and South America, and I need to look this up. But if you Google it, there is a town that celebrates, not the Confederacy. It's like America Town or something like that. I learned this from, was it Discovery or was it the History Channel? History Channel was good for, talking about Hitler and the Civil War, like nobody's business. And so I'm pretty sure I learned this from the History Channel. But there were a lot of Confederate sympathizers and former leaders, soldiers, but not soldiers, captains, leadership, who fled to Mexico and fled to South America. What we also know is that, I think, actually, let me skip up a little bit. Between World War I and World War II, a lot of Europeans fled to Mexico, fled to Central America and South America for different reasons. Not all of them were Hitler connected. Some of them were fleeing Stalin. Some of them were fleeing Mussolini. Who's that Spanish? Mussolini was the Italian dictator. Stalin was the Russian one. Who was the Spanish one? I can't remember his name. Generalissimo something. Anyway, but people were fleeing. White Europeans of either leftist backgrounds were fleeing in World War I to Central and South America. And in World War II, it was Hitler-connected people who were fleeing to Central and South America, but then also the United States, as evidenced by the shows that were coming out. What was it, Operation Paperclip, where the U.S. government helped them flee, some of the scientists flee to steal their technology, or at least have them, the scientists, work for them. Anyway, so we know a lot of white people who were not native to Central and South America fled there and started whole lives over there. And as a result, I think one of the things that Tenoch Huerta is speaking to is that you have people who, you have generations of people who identify as being, from his perspective, Mexican. Certainly colorism is, this is where I'm going. Colorism is a global issue. But specifically in Mexico, what Tenoch Huerta is talking about is not necessarily that there are white people who identify as Mexican, but that there is a desire to only feature or to favor white skin on social media, on TV, in politics, in prominent society, because it is deemed the appropriate thing to do. And I think that there is, I don't know that he said this, but I've listened to other TikTok creators who've shared this. There is a phrase in the Latinx Hispanic community. I don't know about the Hispanic community, but the Latinx, Central and South America, and certainly in the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, there is a feeling, or at least there's a sentiment that is expressed that is essentially something like advancing the race, but in this context, it's advancing it by lightening the race. Lightening the culture, lightening, so literally going from being brown skin to being lighter skin. And that is advancing your race. I don't know in the black community if that phrase was ever adopted, but what I do know is that if you go back through and you look at civil rights, at civil rights photos, you see a whole lot more Rosa Parks than you do Fannie Lou Hamers. What am I talking about? What's the difference between Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer? Rosa Parks was a very light-skinned woman. Fannie Lou Hamer, and quote-unquote respectable. Respectability politics is where I think in some aspects colorism hid for the black community in the United States, because a Fannie Lou Hamer was more boisterous and outspoken in some aspects than at Rosa Parks. Nevertheless, they both served well for the Black community. But our response to them in many ways is different, was different because of respectability. Respectability said you talked a certain way, you dressed a certain way, you looked a certain way. And what we're becoming more aware of now is that, probably we were always aware of this, but I'm more aware of it now, that in the civil rights movement, a lot of the leaders were handpicked because of their attractiveness and their family situation. There was a reason why MLK was chosen. He had the picturesque family. He had a light-skinned wife, a beautiful wife. I don't know that it was because she was white, light-skinned, but he was a preacher. He wasn't actually on, he was just light brown. I wouldn't say that he was just brown skin, but beautiful family, picturesque. We all know that MLK had a lot of flaws, as the FBI tried to expose and harassed Coretta about. But nevertheless, he was straight. He was married and he had kids. And the woman that was on his arm was beautiful. And so he was young when he was pushed forward. And so that was one of the reasons why he was pushed to the forefront. Rosa Parks was pushed to the forefront over, there was a young woman who had sat down on the Montgomery bus boycott before, but she was a teenager and she had a kid out of wedlock. And so they didn't want to put her up. They didn't want to use her as an example. They wanted someone who was a Rosa Parks figure. Now, again, I don't 100% believe that colorism was totally in this, but colorism definitely had a place over the years in our civil rights movement. Certainly, all you need to do is look at the photos of the individuals. I don't believe that it's totally happenstance that a lot of the prominent figures in the Harlem Renaissance, or even to, again, going back to civil rights movement, were lighter complected Black folks. I don't think that's an accident. Thurgood Marshall himself was a very bright skinned Black person. I think there was a responsibility there that maybe they understood that we don't really understand now, and that they assumed those roles, recognizing that they were being a representative of their quote unquote race. But nevertheless, that's a way that colorism expressed itself in the 1900s for us in the Black community. So to see that, I guess I never paid attention to how colorism impacted other communities, because colorism in the Black community was right there in my face. I had talked about colorism before on the show, and I talked about it in the context of some of my Asian friends talking about how colorism plays into a role in the Asian diaspora, with Korean, well, I mean, everybody knows this now, but when I would go to school, when I was in college, I would see Asian women walking with long sleeves in the summertime, walking with long sleeves on, long pants, and an umbrella or a hat. And I was like, boy, you're hot. But my friend who was from Hawaii, Linda Ho, she was a very smart woman, very wise beyond her years. But one of the things that she told me straight up, I don't even know how we got to this conversation, but she told me straight up, she was like, oh, they're trying to protect their skin because they want to remain white. They want to remain light. She didn't say white. I read it, it translated white, but she said they were trying to remain as light as possible because dark skin is in the Asian diaspora in many Asian countries is considered to be poor. Only people who in working class, only people who are poor and work out in the sun all day are brown. We are white. We have porcelain, again, not white, but porcelain skin. is the phrase that kept coming up. And that blew my mind when she told me that, because again, up until this point, my connection to colorism was only to the Black community. I didn't realize colorism was a thing all over. And then flash forward, what, 15 years, and we've got bleaching. Bleaching is a product that is in just about every, if you're not careful, there are bleaching components in almost every K-pop beauty item. Bleaching is an issue across the globe, specifically, it's an issue across the globe, in South Asian countries, in African countries, in the United States, in the Caribbean, in South America. It's a global issue. So that's a conversation that I think everybody's been having. And then I recognized that when I would turn on telenovelas that the villains tended to be darker and the heroines and heroes tended to be lighter skin, but I guess I didn't truly understand how far reaching that ideal was. I didn't realize that until, to be honest with you, I didn't realize until listening to Mexican creators talking about or responding to what Tenoch Huerta was talking about and the colorism that he's talking about. I don't know that he uses colorism. I don't think he uses those words, but he's like, brown people don't get opportunities. I'm a fluke. I made the most out of an opportunity that I was given, but I'm a fluke. The brown people who look, he keeps saying moreno, brown people that look like me. That's the only one of the few Spanish words I remember from all of my, so I got to get back on the wagon. But anyway, I got to get back on the good foot of trying to learn Spanish. But in looking at the interpretations of what he's saying or the translation of what he's saying, he's like, brown people don't look like me, or brown people that look like me don't make it on your big screen TV. I'm one of the few. And in response to him saying that, I'm reminded that from the Mexican creators that I, why are they Mexican? That I think I'm assuming that they're Mexican. They're part of the diaspora. I think I'm assuming that they're Mexican. I think a few of them literally have Mexican flags in their bio. I don't know that every one of them that's talking about this issue is Mexican. I think they're a part of the diaspora, but they might not be Mexican. But of the ones that I'm remembering that have been talking about Huerta's comments, they've been agreeing with him, and they've been showing the national media's response to it. And overwhelmingly, it's been negative, saying, oh, he's being divisive and we are one people. And you and I both know that that's not true. We're not one people. And when I'm saying the we, I'm talking about in any culture, in any, the USA, when you start saying we're one people, that's the same sentiment that Americans say, we are one people. Remember that same sentiment that France was saying when they won the World Cup, and everybody was saying that Africa won the World Cup because of all the African brown skin, African diaspora people that were on their soccer team, and how everybody, black folks and everybody in the African diaspora was saying, oh, Africa won the World Cup. And then a lot of French natives, and even I think some fancy person in government released a statement saying they are the French team. They're not African. They're the French team. And they completely missed the moment. They missed it completely. You're so angered. We're not one country. No matter what country you're coming from, we're not one country. We are the communities that we represent first. And in those moments, like Huerta is representing brown skin Latinx people. That's who he's representing. This film, as I'm understanding it from, I thought that Huerta was indigenous, because in my ignorance, I literally thought only people who had indigenous histories were that brown. So I'm really eager to understand, if he doesn't identify as indigenous, where does his complexion come from? That's what, when you look like, when you are brown skin in the black community, you're brown skin because you are either an African descendant of slaves or a black African-American descendant. What am I saying? A descendant of African slaves in the United States. I forgot the phrase, but you know what I mean. If you are brown skin in the United States, it's because you're a descendant of Africans who were kidnapped and put into slavery. If you are brown and darker on the African continent, it is literally because your ancestors are there. You are connected to people who were from the continent, a country on the continent. That's why you're like, you could say that they're indigenous connected. Do you know what I mean? Like indigenous to the continent of Africa, right? And so that's where our color comes from. I don't know what he's meaning when he's saying, I don't identify as indigenous. And I'm like, that's the only question I have. But nevertheless, he identifies as Latino, but he's representing the brown people of the community. And the response to that is kind of wild, but not, it doesn't surprise me. I just didn't realize that colorism was that deep in Mexico as well, or in the Latinx community as a whole, Latinx and Hispanic community, because I follow indigenous creators, and I follow Mexican creators and people from the diaspora. I don't know if I follow anybody on, I'm talking about on TikTok. I don't know if I follow anybody from who identifies as being from Spain. But yeah, definitely a lot of South American, Central and South American creators is what I'll say. And there's a large conversation around white, what are they calling it? Wexicans? Whitekins? Because certainly the conversation is that Whitekins are frustrated at the representation or at what they're considering to be the divisive conversation that Huerta's bringing up. And their response to it is much like the response that we have in the black community, which is really, in my opinion, the only response. The minute that you start denying the fact that different communities exist, the minute that you start denying the fact that colorism isn't a thing, that's precisely the minute that you've lost the argument. Just like in France, Africa did win because of all of the diaspora people that were on their team when they won the World Cup. The same is true when a Mexican who identifies as Latino but represents brown Latinos who are often not represented calls out the fact that he's doing it for them and that this film is not necessarily even representing Latinos. It's representing, because his character is indigenous. The character that he plays, Cucucal, is indigenous. And he's representing that character is indigenous representation. Again, a big thing. If you pay attention to South American politics, you know that in the last, 20 years, there have been indigenous people that have captured power, not captured power, but have been elected to power in certain countries, Latin American or South American countries. And that's been a big deal because it's not typical for you to see someone brown skin wearing traditional cultural clothing in office. And so it raises it to a level of importance because it's not something you see all the time. And so Huerta's comments are also drawing attention to that. Again, one of the things that he said in his many interviews about his representation and recognizing what it means is that you do not see people who look like me in leadership often.
And so he's doing what he's doing, calling attention to it as a way to let people that look like him know, little kids that look like him know that, hey, we can do this. And then also speaking truth to power. And he's making a lot of people upset. But I love this conversation because at the end of the day, you have to acknowledge it so that we can move forward with it. It's not good enough to say, oh, we're trying, and then you just don't. You have to have the conversation. This is the only way that we can get forward and actually do the work. Otherwise, you can't shut it down. And so this is interesting. Again, I'm on the peripheries of this. I'm just trying to pick up the pieces and try to learn more. Again, I didn't realize that. I do want to understand his background because I assumed that he was indigenous, but he's saying that he's not. And so I guess I'm wondering if it's one of those things where, yeah, I don't know why. I'm just ignorant to the culture and I need to learn more. How about that? Anyway, I wanted to get that off my chest, though, before I moved it on to talking about the film, because I think outside of the film, I think that's an important conversation. And I just love the fact. I love the fact that I grew up thinking that Latinx people did not like Black folks. And I know that there's a lot of anti-Blackness in every culture, including Black culture. I know that. But I just love the fact that this feels like a connecting moment. Truly a connecting moment. An anti-colonization and pro-brown people unite moment. That is, it is not without its nuance, obviously. But it's interesting because I've never seen this. I've never seen anything like it on TV. I've never seen anything like it in media. I've seen comedies about it, you know, people making jokes and stuff. But what I grew up hearing was that Latinx folk didn't like you because you're Black and they're anti-Black. That's not all true. It's not all wrong, but it's not all true either. And I've also heard very racist statements coming from Black folk about Latinx people. I've heard it too, but it all comes from a source of colonization. We use the language of the colonizers, including the oppressive language of the colonizers, to differentiate ourselves because that is the nature of colonization. You're always supposed to be dominant, trying to always dominate someone else. But in this context, what I like about this movie, and it's fictitious, y'all. It's fictitious. It's based in reality a little bit, but it's fictitious. Mostly the Dora Milaje are based off the Dahomey. Even Kukulcan himself is based off, in a lot of ways, Moctezuma. Right? That powerful Aztec leader. Anyway, but nevertheless, this is fantasy. But it's bringing forth a conversation and several conversations that I think are pretty awesome. And once again, there's a Hotepian piece to this that we'll have to get to, but I'll talk about that in the next segment. And I'll try not to keep you for 2 hours, but I just definitely do want to get this off my chest. So stay tuned. Okay, so before I get into it, I completely just rushed through because I was so excited to talk about some of the aspects of the movie that were connected but not really relevant to the movie discussion itself that I skipped over this part. So my sorority just turned 100 on Saturday. I'm still recovering from the wild weekend that I had in celebration of it. But also, the day that this comes out is the 111th. Anniversary of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated. So happy Founders Day to those, the men of that organization. But anyway, all right, well, let me get into this thing. All right, so Wakanda Forever is a 2 hour and 41 minute movie. It does not feel like it's 2 hours and 41 minutes. It was released on November 11th, so the day before my sorority's Founders Day, Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated. 1922, November 12th, 1922. Anyway, director Ryan Coogler, released in English. Film series is part of Black Panther, based on the comic books by the same name. Screenplay by Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole, distributed by Disney. It stars Chadwick Boseman, Tenoch Huerta, who I've been talking about a lot, who y'all have been lusting over, by the way. I mean, he cute, nerd. He fine. He is fine. Anyway, Letitia Wright, Michael B. Jordan. I'm spoiling some stuff, but anyway, Michael B. Jordan, Dominic Thorne, as Riri Williams, whose character's name is Ironheart, and I forgot her name. It's Ironheart. Angela Bassett is Ramonda, Queen Mother. Who else is in here? Shuri played by Letitia Wright. Michaela Cole is in this as Aneka. Danai Gurira as Okoye. Okoye. I'm gonna talk about her for a second. And Lupita Nyong'o as Nakia. And who plays Jabari? Winston Duke plays Jabari. There are a total of 5 white people in this whole main cast. You gotta love it. You gotta love it. But then also Julia Louis-Dreyfus is in here, and I don't recognize her character. I don't recognize her character in the series unless she's trying to play. She's playing what Alfred Wooder's character was in the animated series. Somebody let me know that. If you've watched Black Panther 2, is Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character supposed to replace Alfred Wooder's character in the series? I'll put that as a comment too. So indigenous characters, Mabel Cadena. I think she's in. She plays Namora. Tenoch Huerta plays Namor. Who else is in here? Alex Livinali plays Atuma, who is one of the big characters. That's a big bad guy. Yeah, so there are 4. 3. Well, there are 3 that are mentioned here. Obviously, there are more, but there are 3 main cast. Oh, 4. Maria Mercedes Coroy. So yeah, so it is 4 main people. And I think she plays, I forgot who, I think she plays one of the sirens, which I'll talk about in a second, but Namora is Namor's, which is what Kukulcan's enemies call him. Kukulcan's enemies call him Namor. And Namora is like his number 2. Right. Okay. So that's who's in it. And I guess I'll go back to Okoye. Okay. Here's the overview. Queen Ramunda, Shuri, M'Baku, Okoye, and the Dora Milaje fight to protect their nation from intervening world powers in the wake of King T'Challa's death. As the Wakandians strive to embrace their next chapter, the heroes must band together with Nakia and Everett Ross to forge a new path for their beloved kingdom. Okay, Everett Ross, that is the one white person that gets purchased in this film, like for realsies. They're really trying to make him not a villain. Martin Freeman plays Everett Ross, who was married. It feels like he was married at one point to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character, who, again, I'm not so sure that is replacing Alfred Wooder. But anyway. So the opening scene, the first 15 minutes of this film is basically paying homage to T'Challa and really Chadwick Boseman. It's very tearful and frustrating. And Queen Ramunda. Is it? I'm messing up already. Is it Ramunda? Where'd she go? Where's Alf? Oh, Angela. Okay. Ramunda? How do you say her name? Queen Ramunda. She's gray-haired. Almost reminded me of a little bit of Storm. You know what I mean? Like a short-haired Storm. because it's Angela Bassett. Jeez, she's gorgeous. Anyway, so Ramunda's character is before, after we have the scene, it's a very beautiful scene that you absolutely need to see, so I'm not even going to describe it. You absolutely need to go see it yourself. But after the homegoing service, essentially is what that is, we instantly see Ramunda, Angela's character, the queen. How about that? We see the queen being queen, reluctantly so, but being queen. And we also see Shuri not really grieving well. And I said, I'm going to put a pin in grieving for a second, but let me just walk through this. So what you need to know about the whole film in a nutshell is that the queen is having to make some difficult choices. She's having to answer the question that T'Challa never quite answered, which is, will Wakanda remain on in the neutral zone, knowing that the world government is having an unusual curiosity about their weaponry and how they power their society, but specifically vibranium, how they use vibranium. The world wants it. They think it's not fair that Wakanda has it. And we see Queen Ramunda being very strong and saying, try me, I'm gonna try you even harder. Basically, this is a bad faith argument. You're saying that we're being the big bad guys because we have all the superpower. We're not leveling the playing field. Meanwhile, you're using every single tactic in the book to undermine me. Also, I'm still grieving and I don't know what to do. And my baby won't grieve. My baby's not grieving either. So why don't you let me alone? My husband is gone. Now my son is gone. All I have left in this world is my kingdom and my child. And y'all are fooling with me right now. Y'all are messing up my vibe and I'm out this bee. Anyway, she didn't quite say it like that, but you get my meaning. Like she's a leader in a moment that she cannot truly grieve. Remember, at the start of Black Panther, her husband has been killed. He's dead. Killed in an accident of the Avengers thingy. I can't remember exactly how he passed, but it was like a bomb or something like that. He was speaking to the UN, and anyway, he passed away. And then we're thinking, what, 2-3 years later, my son passes away too? In a moment where our country really needs a leader, and now I must be the leader I was never intending to be. And I'm still grieving my son, and I'm still also grieving the fact that when he was alive, our country was torn apart by this rogue man that claimed to be my nephew, that my husband hid from me, whose father, he killed his boy's father, which was his brother, I guess. And so anyway, still grappling with the fact that people chose sides. We know that Daniel Kaluuya's character, who's not in this film, by the way, Daniel Kaluuya's character was love interest or partner to Okoye, and his people took sides and chose what was Michael B. Jordan's character's name? Michael B. Jordan. Anyway, Michael B. Jordan's character, I can't call it, but took his side, and there was war. Y'all remember the ending? It was war amongst the Wakandans. And so she's still picking. So my husband's been gone for a couple of years and that hurt. My baby, I just buried my son who was the promised one. And so I'm queen and I'm trying to pick up the pieces. And I ain't forgot that y'all, that there was division. Or y'all were too easily fooled and swayed by this young buck that came in and challenged my baby's authority. And so what we have here is a woman that's grieving and a woman who's bitter and scorned. Maybe not bitter, but scorned. And there is an argument that says that some of the moves that she makes, including a very strong argument that she has with Okoye, that changes Okoye's relationship to the kingdom, or at least the relationship to the ruling family. I'll say that. There's an argument that said that she's acting out of emotion. There's also an argument that says this woman has been through a lot and she needs some people who are unquestioning, unflinching, and steady Eddies in her corner. In a moment where, again, her kingdom is still, her queendom is still picking up the pieces from essentially their own civil war, started by an outsider who was actually Wakandian. And also, here come these Americans still steady trying to steal our resources. And my baby gone. And I'm trying to keep this other one safe. And she not playing ball. We see Shuri questioning her own spirituality, her own faith in her community. We see her also blaming herself. Grief is a powerful, powerful thing. And if you think that if you watch this film and you think Shuri's actions, especially in the beginning half, I'd say the first hour, Shuri's actions, Queen Ramonda's actions, if you think they're irrational, you're right. But also they're justified. Why? Because grief is a terrible feeling, a terrible emotion, but one we will all experience and one that we need to just allow to feel and sit with and allow ourselves to get over and to find our new normal. Because as evidenced in the film, grief will make you to respond to environmental situations differently than you might have done before you were grieving. And we see that in the Queen. Again, there's a very powerful moment between her and Okoye where she questions a lot. Queen Ramonda questions a lot. And Angela Bassett acted her face off in that scene. There's lots of moments of levity. But there's also a moment where you want to scream at Shuri. There are several moments where you want to scream at Shuri because of her choices. Again, everything is laid out for her just to walk through, but except for how to grieve. Her mother, Queen Ramonda, tries to walk her through the grieving process, but you can only walk through the grieving process if you are willing to let go. And part of the anger and frustration that people have that prevent them from grieving is because they're not willing to let go of what was and walk into what is. I'm not a grief counselor. I'm a person that's gone through grief myself. And it's not as pretty as it's not neat and tight as I just described it. But nevertheless, one of the ways that you do walk through grief is to acknowledge that what was is no more. And that's a hard one to do. And what we see in Shuri is that in big ways and small ways, she just wants to act like nothing happened. Like she knows that it did happen, that she has this hole in her heart, but she's not willing to face the hole in her heart. And instead, she pours herself into her science. She makes reckless decisions. She takes risks that she should not take, that she would probably not normally take, but for her running from her grief. She finally gets to address her grief at the end, but there's 2 hours of the film done gone already before we get to that moment. But that's real life. She's also faced with the fact that she's heavy grieving because some other things happen related to the Queen that make her really face facts. But we see two people grieving deeply. And then we see a third in Nakia, who, as I mentioned, she was on the periphery. We always knew that she was T'Challa's love interest and that they were going to be together because T'Challa was smitten with her. But that she was trying to find her place in Wakanda. And like she knew her place in Wakanda, but she was trying to carve out her own path to using her unique skills and talents to support her kingdom in the ways that made sense. In this film, her approach to grief feels like totally running away from Wakanda at all and just being excluded from the narrative completely. We learn that that's not quite the situation. I invite you to stay to the credits. If you watch this, when you watch this film, I invite you to stay to watch the credits, because when you go through the credits, more information will be revealed. By now, you should know. When the credits come on, you never leave the theater. For a Marvel film, never leave the theater, baby. There's something more always. Anyway, but I said in the intro that Nakia steps up more than she in a more prominent way than she perhaps did in the first Black Panther film. Her queen, Queen Ramonda, asked her to complete a task. And there's a sense of urgency and there's a sense of loyalty and duty that, I'm gonna be honest with you, didn't feel was there as strongly in the first one as is now. But that's because some things have changed. I will not spoil what has changed for Nakia, other than, I mean, grief was a part of it, but it's not the reason why Nakia changed and has a different approach to her place in the world and her place in Wakanda. I will say that this change sent her to Haiti, and spending a lot of time there at an orphanage, or not an orphanage, but a school. A lot of kids around her. And it's not really super explained until the very end. And so again, I invite you to stay and watch the full thing. But her queen asks her to do a task. And not only does she do this task, she does it expertly, with precision. She does what others can't do. There is a moment where Queen gets all off. I said there's a moment where she has with Okoye, where Okoye's place in the kingdom is changed. Okoye does something that grieves very much the queen. And as a result, Nakia is called in to do what Okoye could not do. And that's a humiliating moment, but it's also an opportunity for Okoye. And the opportunity does come back around in the end, but there was some hard things happening in this film. And I recognize that there are some things that are happening in this film that a lot of people will not like, because it's a Disney film. You want the hero. You want to feel like it's wrapped up in a pretty bow. And this film, to its credit, to Ryan Coogler's credit, this film is not wrapped up in a pretty bow. If anything, this film sets up 3-4 different storylines to come. Let me talk about Ironheart, Riri Williams. Namor, his sole purpose of engaging with the Wakandan, with the Wakandian people and Queen Ramonda, is because he has a purpose for Ironheart. Because the U.S. government has a purpose for Ironheart, too. Everything that Namor does, he says he does it for his people. His origin story is something to behold. I'll tell it to you now. Namor was a child born on the water. Maybe not born. He was born on the water, but he becomes a child of the water because of famine and disease. And because he becomes born of water, there's a unique reason why he's born of water. And it has a lot to do with Wakanda and the reason why they have the Black Panther. I'll just let that marinate. That should be your millionth reason why you watch it. There's a connection here. And Namor is powerful and special and has lived a long life. And in living a long life, in learning his story, what we know is that he has seen the ways of the West, specifically the ways of the colonizers. He knows how this story plays out. He didn't heard the song before. He's been around long enough to hear it. And so when he meets with Ramunda, he presents an opportunity that Queen Ramunda is not ready to entertain. Again, I've told you, the kingdom of Wakanda is at a crossroads and was at a crossroads before T'Challa passed. And so Namor sits with the queen, meets with the queen and says point blank, period, I got an offer. You in or you out? Also gives her an ultimatum on some old, you bet not. And when you talk to a queen, especially a newly minted queen, who's not here for the foolishness, you don't tell her what she will and won't do. She ain't a fool, but you don't tell her. You don't talk to her like that. And so that picture that came out with Namor, as played by, I love saying his name, Namor, as played by Tenoch Huerta, when he's up in Ramunda's face, girl, that scene is hard. That's a rough and tumble scene right there. So anyway, Ramunda is introduced to Namor when he's giving her an opportunity. The next time he's faced to face with Ramunda, she insults him. The very next time he's face to face with Ramunda, their relationship is completely changed and Wakanda is changed. There's something brewing in this universe. And you think it's because it's of Namor, but it's Namor's response to the US. The conversation that is being had here is more pronounced in this movie than it was in the first, but it is the conversation that is being had in the comics, which is the West, led by the United States, ain't this all-American place, this wholesome place that you think it is. They are colonizers. Do not believe in the myth of Captain America. He's a machine built and designed to be a machine. The Winter Soldier is a killing machine. The Winter Soldier is a killing machine that is the killing machine that Captain America was not. Captain America was the pretty face and for truth and justice. But nevertheless, Winter Soldier was America's real face as told in the comics. She never to trust them. Namor is reminding you of that, of this in this world. Namor is saying, I done been here, I done did this, and let me tell you what's fixing to happen. What you already know is fixing to happen. Also, I see only one way out of this. Either lay people down or get laid down. And I'm not finna get laid down. That's Namor's point. But wasn't that Michael B. Jordan's point? His point was a little bit different. You got black people and people in other African countries being oppressed, which was Nakia's point. Why are you not using your powers for good instead of just hiding out? The world needs to know what's up. Namor and Michael B. Jordan's character would have been good friends. One of them would have died in the end, but they would have been friends for a minute. But they would have definitely fought and fought to the death. One of them would have been dead. Probably Michael B. Jordan's character, because he was already no shade, but he was already dead. He was already killed in the first one. He probably would have been folded by Namor, but that's not the point. That was Michael B. Jordan's point of view. That was Nakia's. Nakia was more new. She had more nuance and more class with hers. Michael B. Jordan's character was like, nah, I want to light the world on fire because look at how they do us. And so anyway, Namor comes with that same energy. That same energy, but done in a different way because he's got age. What we know about Namor, and this is not a spoiler, Namor is centuries old. So he not new to this, he true to it. And so some things happen that put him in direct conversation with Shuri. And there are some moments. Now, Tenochtitlan, I know he had fun with this character. I know he did. Because he has some cool moments. And there's a moment that he was like, all right, I told your mama. Now I'm going to give you the opportunity. All right, let's talk. Let's talk like world leaders. What's up? What's up? You next in line. I need you to get on the good foot. Toward the end, what we know is that Shuri's place in the kingdom is changed, elevated even. And she now has to, she doesn't have beef with Namor. Well, there is a moment where they just don't quite see eye to eye. But they get on the same page at the end. But what we think is Namor being schooled is actually Namor playing a longer game. Because again, he done been here before. And so there's a whole lot that I'm skipping over completely and it needs to be skipped over. There's a certain point where Martin Freeman's character is literally, he is literally used to advance the plot. He is actually presented as a traitor to his nation, traitor to the U.S., Everett Scott or Everett Ross. Anyway, they just keep him around. And I really don't know his purpose anymore because in the first film and in most of the second one, his purpose was to funnel intelligence from the U.S. to Wakanda, to the leadership in Wakanda. Like that was his whole purpose. I don't know what his purpose is now. Because some things have changed with him as well. So anyway, this film was not without its flaws. There's a big flaw in terms of how Shuri got to her leadership position. It's hardcore. How she got elevated. It was hardcore. But there's a hole in the heart of this thing, which is, first off, is Wakanda united? Is Shuri the leader? Can Shuri be a leader that Wakanda needs? What is the United States fixing to do? Like that's an end question, but and what do Namor got brewing? There's a lot of unanswered questions here, and I think perhaps it's on purpose. I feel like sometimes how we got from point A to point B was a little bit rushed. Nevertheless, it was still good movie watching. I don't know. I know that there will be a Black Panther 3, especially when that ending credit scene happens. There will absolutely be a Black Panther 3. The Panther lineage is not gone. It's alive and well. Nakia has a new place in this kingdom and I'm eager to see her step up. I don't know what sort of leader Shuri's going to be, but I know that she's trying her hardest, to figure this thing out. Riri Williams, AKA Ironheart. I don't know what's going to happen with her. I did not read her storyline in the comics. And Namor and Namora, there's something that's about to go down. Like, I'm not so sure if Namora is fixing to run after Namor. For real. Cause like, there feels like there's a crack in the relationship there. You'll see what I mean when you watch it. But yeah, I don't know what Everett Ross is doing there. He just on the periphery, but we know some big stuff about to happen. But what we know is that there's an opportunity for Namor to have his own film, Ironheart to have hers. Shuri, of course, is going to have hers. Nakia. And where is Storm? I need Storm introduced ASAP. Get her on the line. Let's go. Anyway, watch the film. It was super fun. I'm definitely going to watch it a couple of more times because I want two things. I want to see it in the film. There's nothing like seeing a good film in the theaters on the big screen. And also, I want to pump up their numbers because it deserves. And yeah, so I hope I didn't spoil it too much. I definitely left a lot of breadcrumbs in there. Please watch the film. Please go watch it. Go buy you a ticket. Get somebody to buy it for you. Go watch this film. It's real, real good. It's another moment in the culture. And what I love about it is not just the Black culture, the African diaspora. It's another moment that was created for the Latinx culture, specifically brown Latinx people. I love it. To see Latinx creators get excited, brown Mexican creators get excited about this representation and getting all dressed up and looking cute and stuff. Love it. That they're simping over evil old Namor, which dude is a little bit evil. They're over here simping and falling over him and saying, I saw this one Mexican creator. She was like, she used that, the waiting to exhale. He's a good man, Savannah. He's just a little lost or whatever she says. I saw that. I almost died seeing that. It was hilarious. Anyway, I'm excited. This is just scrumptious. I also love the conversation, even though a lot of people are butthurt about it. Check your privilege. Get into it. It's not always about you. Stand to the rear. If they're not talking about you, stand to the rear. This ain't for you. You can still enjoy. You can still enjoy. Okay. But right now it's for the Black and brown. Right. And the brown. That's what we on right now. We're here for all colors, but we celebrating brown right now. And I'm here for it. Anyway, I just love the fact that little brown Latinx kids can see themselves reflected. I can't wait for the Halloween. Oh my goodness. I cannot wait for the Halloween costumes. Little boo-boos with little face, the clear little face mask with the little blue paint all in their hair and stuff. Mama and daddy's place all messed up. Granny's place messed up. And then the little Namors. Actually they're going to have to put on like little baby shirts, little baby sweaters or something like that. I don't know how they're gonna work it out for Halloween, but they're gonna work it out and I cannot wait. Do you hear me? Also, I'm finna get a cat suit. Yep. I don't know where I'm gonna wear it, but I'm finna get like a panther cat suit. I'm gonna just prance around because I'm ready for it. It's time. I didn't do it the last time. I'm fixing to do that. I'm finna get me a cat suit. Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm gonna be a panther. Anyway, that's my Halloween outfit for next year. Anyway, y'all, appreciate you listening. There's so many other more things that I could have talked about this episode, but I just wanted to talk all things Black Panther and conversations that Black Panther brought up because this has just been very exciting to look at the content on TikTok. And again, y'all are lusty McLust. I thought y'all was lusting after Michael B. Jordan's character. Girl, y'all need the Lord. These videos. Ooh, y'all, are you cold showers for everyone? Anyway, all right. Have a good day. Thanks for listening. Thanks for rating this show 4 or 5 stars and sharing this with somebody who you think might dig it. Appreciate you. Have a great day. Be kind to yourself. Until next time. Take your medicine too. And take some cold medicine. Put a cough drop in there. Put some around your neck also. It's time for a cold. Put some around your neck. Put some on your head. All right? Anyway, until next time. Take care.